Okay, we're turning again this morning to the 8th chapter of Ezekiel's prophecy. Ezekiel 8, and we're making our way through this chapter as a key illustration of the manifestation of sin in these people to whom the prophet was preaching. Keeping in mind that the dual theme of Ezekiel is the judgment and restoration of God. The judgment comes because the people are deserving of that judgment. They have merited, they have earned the punishment that God is going to bring upon them. And so we've been taking some time to demonstrate the emphasis that Ezekiel places upon the sin of the people. They were arguing that what they were experiencing was not their fault. They were casting blame always on somebody else, either their fathers or the government or somebody else, but failing to acknowledge their own individual responsibility and accountability before God. And so Ezekiel takes great pains to demonstrate that these people individually were responsible and they had merited the punishment that God was bringing to them. Oh yes, their ancestors had failed as well. And their fathers indeed had eaten those sour grapes. And their fathers were guilty. But the time was now ripe for God to judge these people, and they themselves had merited the punishment and chastisement that God was going to bring upon them. So there is a great emphasis in Ezekiel's preaching upon the sin of the people to make it clear that God is not judging without cause. There is good basis, there is good reason. Now we've spent these last few weeks developing that theme. We've looked at various passages right through the book that develop this idea. But we're taking a little time through the 8th chapter because it really is going to be a bridge that links the sin of the people to the actual consequence of that sin, as we'll see as we come to the end of this portion. But it's a good chapter because it reveals the internal heart nature of their sin that manifested itself in their various social acts and their various lives, even outside of their religious experience. Now, it's a chapter that is a vision. We saw that in the opening verses last week as God came to Ezekiel now some little time after that initial vision of the holiness of God. And he takes him by the hair of his head and drags him in the spirit back to the very temple of Jerusalem, remembering that Ezekiel himself is captive in Babylon. But God is now taking him back to his homeland. And he's going to give him a vision of what's taking place in the temple that under normal circumstances, only the Lord himself was able to see. To look at what was happening in the temple from human eyes, it would seem that everything there was going according to law. Everything was going according to expectation. They were bringing in their sacrifices. They were going through the rituals of worship exactly as they ought to have done. It appeared that they were indeed a most religious people. But God is allowing Ezekiel to look through the external practice of their religion to the very nature of their heart, and he sees that while they are going through the motions of their religion, their hearts were far from God. And while they were in the temple of the Lord, professing to worship the Lord, their hearts were given to false and pagan gods. Here is the nature of their heart. Well, they could go through the motions, but God viewed the heart. And there's a great lesson here for us, that God is not satisfied just with the performance of religious acts. God is never satisfied just with a purely external religion that has no true heart for Him. He was not satisfied in Ezekiel's day, and He's not satisfied in our day. We can come to the church, and we can go through all the motions of worshiping the Lord, and we can say the right things and do the right things. And to those around us, it may appear, yes, we are the worshipers of the Lord, but God looks at our hearts. And what does He really see in our hearts as we go through all the motions even here on this Lord's Day? God, I say, is not looking just at what we do on the outside, but He's looking at the spirit and the motive and what indeed is in our hearts. So we have this vision then of the temple. We saw that he saw the temple or the holiness of God, the glory of God was there. But the sad thing that the people were driving out the glory of God. There were two things in the temple where should have been just the one. There was this imagery of jealousy that we were discussing last time. Now, we want to then look at some detail after the disclosure of this false worship. And as we noted, there are various degrees of abomination that are demonstrated in our text. We're looking then at this disclosure, first of all, at the practice of their false worship. And we said a little bit last week about this image of jealousy, this image that provokes to jealousy that was erected here in the temple, at least in the hearts of their people. Now, indeed, there was a time, as we saw back in 2 Kings 21, during the days, those wicked reign, that wicked reign of Manasseh, where this grove was in reality established and erected in the very temple of God. Manasseh, that wicked king who was most perverse in his practices, introducing all types of religious atrocities into the land. Indeed, in a very literal sense, during the reign of Manasseh, this grove, remember this pole, this Asherah, had been erected in the very temple. Now, I don't think by Ezekiel's day there had been religious reform that had been long torn down. And I don't think that we see in Ezekiel's vision here, or in the literal temple that existed in Ezekiel's day, that this image was there erected. I don't think so. I think rather the temple was restored, remember, under the days of Josiah, back to what it ought to have been. And we're not long after that period here. Rather than seeing this as being a literal fixture, we see it as a manifestation of what was in their heart. But the significant thing here of this image of jealousy, if it is indeed that grove, that Asherah, representing that goddess of love, the Asherah in Canaanite worship, in Baal worship, was the goddess of love, and around that grove, around that pole in the Canaanite mythology and Baal worship were all types of religious perversions taking place. It was filled with fornication. It was a terrible, perverse practice. And while these people were in the house of God, here's where their heart was. They had in the place of the altar, and that was the key point that I tried to bring out last week, this image was erected right there at the northern gate, the place where the altar should have been, the place of sacrifice, the place where the blood was shed. These people were substituting the goddess of love for the place of sacrifice. And they were trying to make their approach to God apart from blood. And this was the first thing that God was looking for. There is no approach to God apart from blood. We emphasized that and studied that this last summer in our survey of Leviticus. That whole book is teaching us that God's way demands blood, and there is no approach to God apart from that blood. At the very beginning of the temple entrance, there was the altar, there was the place of sacrifice. And these people had set aside the place of sacrifice. They had set aside the altar of the blood, and they had erected this goddess of love, indicating that they had a far different view of God than what Ezekiel was preaching to them. Ezekiel was preaching a holy God, and Ezekiel was well impressed with that holiness of God. And there's no approach to that holy God by man's way. They had a wrong conception of what God was and what God was all about. They had a wrong view of themselves. They did not see their own perverseness. They did not see the heinous nature of their hearts. And they felt that just by going through, yes, even this religious rigmarole, that God would be satisfied and God would accept them. They had a wrong view of the nature of their own sin. In many ways, it was Cain worship. That worship without the blood. Now, God is love. God is love, and we understand that God is love. But the love of God is evidenced to His people. And the love of God is experienced by His people only through the sacrifice. And apart from the sacrifice, there's no love of God that sinners know. Apart from the sacrifice and apart from the blood, God is a rejecter of those that are the workers of iniquity. God loves sinners, yes. But God loves sinners only through the blood of the sacrifice. to be a rejecter of the sacrifice. The psalmist declares well that God is a hater of those who are the workers of iniquity. We sometimes get sentimental in our understanding of God's love. God's love is not just a sentimental concept. The love of God is wonderful and it's pure, but it's just and it's holy. And those who are the recipients and the experiencers, the enjoyers of God's love, must know that love only through the blood of the sacrifice. Outside of the blood of the sacrifice, God has no love for the sinner. He's a rejecter of those who reject the blood. And they, I say, had a wrong view of the blood. But the abominations continue. Notice in verse 10. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things, and abominable beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. So the Lord allows the prophet now to cast his eyes upon the objects of their worship. Here first was the idol of imagery, or the of jealousy that provokes the Lord to jealousy. And now he sees, having set aside the blood, he sees all types of these abominable beasts and creeping things. A loathsome picture representing here the baseness of the regenerated hearts that were going through this religious practice. You can't help but think here of what the Apostle Paul says and describes concerning natural man in Romans chapter 1. In Romans 1:21, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations. Their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into the image made like to corruptible man, to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness, to the lusts of their own heart, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves. What Paul is saying here in theological terms, Ezekiel was seeing in vision. Here are these people that had so rejected the Lord. Oh, they'd forsaken the Lord, and in their hearts they had replaced God Himself with all of these corruptible things. And here are these loathsome, repugnant beasts and creeping things that became the real desire of their heart. Oh, but again, on the outside, they were worshiping the Lord. They were saying the right things. They were going to the right place. But here's what was in their heart. Their heart was filled with these loathsome beasts, the baseness, I say, of the unregenerated heart. Once the blood has been rejected, once the way of God has been set aside for your own way, the degeneration is going to grow and grow, and the perverseness is going to become more and more abominable in the sight of God. False religion may give the appearance of respectability, but it's a base and it's a perverted thing. And I keep emphasizing here, but I must, that this perversion, that Ezekiel sees was taking place in the house of God. And it was taking place in the hearts of those that were in the house of God. Just coming into the church building does not clean out our hearts. Just going through all the motions of religion does not purify our hearts. It's very possible, and it's something that we need to be well warned against and pray against in regard to our own hearts and those that worship with us, that our hearts are pure, and that as we come to the house of God, we indeed are worshiping the Lord in spirit and in truth, and that we are free from all of these disgusting things. God sees the heart. But it gets worse. Look at verse 14. Verse 13, and he said unto me, turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. So here it gets worse. First he saw the image of jealousy, the Canaanite goddess of love. Then he saw the abominations, and now he sees the women there weeping for Tammuz. In the Babylonian era, during which Ezekiel here is ministering, Tammuz was one of the significant Babylonian gods. He was a fertility god. He was the god of rising and dying, and dying and rising. He was associated with the agricultural cycle of the nation, of the people, and they viewed Tammuz as being exalted, as being alive, as being on his throne in those times of harvest, when everything was going well and the crops were coming in and there was prosperity. Tammuz was viewed as being alive and well and ruling. But in those times of drought, in the times of famine, when things were not so prosperous, they explained that because then during those periods Tammuz was taken down into the underworld. Tammuz has died, and Tammuz is being held captive by the god of death. And so long as he was there in the underworld, then there would be no prosperity, there would be no harvest, there would be no crops, there would be no blessings upon earth, so long as Tammuz was there. So it was imperative to them to keep Tammuz alive, you see. And so they would worship to Tammuz, and they would give Tammuz and all of these praises and adoration. They'd go through all the rigmarole of worshiping Tammuz just so he would be inclined to stay alive and not be... But here they're weeping for Tammuz, which means apparently that Tammuz was down in the underworld. Now, I don't want to go into a lot of detail here, but this was the very heart of pagan worship. It went by different names depending upon the locality. The Tammuz here of Babylon was the Hadad of Phoenicia and Syria, but the same basic theology. When everything was going well, Hadad was ruling, Baal was ruling, but Baal from time to time would go down into the underworld to be held there captive by the god Death. And it's interesting that in this pagan theology, whether it was under the Babylonian name using Tammuz, or whether it was in the Canaanite name using Baal or Hadad or whoever, basically the theology was the same. For here this god was held into the underworld, and the only way he could escape is if... And it's a little different if in Babylonian mythology, the goddess Ishtar, would go down rescue him from the hold of death. And so it was the mother goddess in Ishtar was the mother goddess in Babylonian theology, and she would go down into the underworld, and she would do whatever had to be done to rescue Tammuz and bring him back up to the realm of the living. In Canaanite literature, it was still a female goddess. It was Baal's sister consort that rescued him, but she would go down and she would do what she had to do to death to allow Baal to be resurrected. And so you have this cycle of a dying and a rising god, a dying and a rising god. He dies, he's held, and then in Babylonian instance here, the mother goddess goes down to rescue him, and it becomes then imperative to keep the mother goddess as well in good form, so she can rescue Tammuz to bring prosperity back to the land. This goddess was a problem as well. It's not mentioned specifically here in Ezekiel's prophecy. But you remember in Jeremiah, contemporary with Ezekiel, he's lamenting those women who are, baking the cakes for the Queen of Heaven. Look at Jeremiah. I'm thinking 44, but I'm not sure. Let me peruse this as I'm talking to you. And as I'm talking to you, I'm not saying anything except wasting time until I find it. There it is. Yes. Jeremiah chapter 44, about verse 18. Verse 17. But we will certainly do whatsoever thing goeth forth out of our own mouth to burn incense unto the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto her, as we have done, we and our fathers, our kings and our princes in the cities of Judah, and in the streets of Jerusalem, for then we had plenty of victuals and were well and saw no evil. But since we were left to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings unto her, we have wanted all things and have been consumed by the sword and by famine. And we were burned, and when we burned incense to the Queen of Heaven and poured out drink offerings unto her, did we make her cakes to worship her and pour out drink offerings unto her without our men and so forth. All right, now you can see what's happening. Here are these women that are limiting the fact. When we gave the Queen of Heaven what she wanted, we prospered. When we stopped, then we didn't prosper any longer. So they were worshiping this Queen of Heaven, not identified by name here, but comparing what we know from the Babylon literature. This was Ishtar. We sometimes speak of the Ishtar Tammuz or the Adonis, sometimes known as Adonis Tammuz cult, where we have this great fertility worship, trying to keep Tammuz well. So long as Tammuz was well, that we were going to prosper. So they bribed the Queen of Heaven to rescue him when necessary. But that's what was taking place here. It would be a digression, but it's one that you may develop. It's often been suggested that some of the Roman theology, yes, that is even prevalent, and the very essence of Roman theology has its origin and is a reflection of this ancient Babylonian and Canaanite cult. It's the essence of pagan worship. The mother goddess having the power to deliver her son. And so it becomes most imperative to do your worshiping of the mother goddess so that she can take care of that son and so forth. I say it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see the parallels. But you can develop that for yourself. There's a classic book that's been written on this, some of it somewhat fanciful, but most of it is right. It is right true, and you can study the Babylon theology yourself and see that it's true. What's it called? Hyslop's Two Babylons or something.
The Masonic rite, very similar.
Is that right? Same thing. Right, right. And this is there, and it's nothing. It's not. It's obviously not Christian theology. This perversion, I say, it's illustrated for us in the Rosh Amra Ugaritic materials that date back to the 15th century B.C. And this is in the region of Canaan, but it's exactly the same theology that's taking place. What's here is Babylonian. This is dating to the 5th century, 6th century B.C., and we have records of the kind of worship even earlier than that. Nothing Christian about it. Yeah, it's a great perversion. But here it was taking place, you see. And I say, here's the greater abomination that Ezekiel sees as he brings the people in, or as he sees the people in the temple, supposedly worshiping the Lord, but instead worshiping and weeping over Tammuz. Now, there's a lot of ways and a lot of implications to that, certainly. But could I just broaden the significance of that for a moment, broaden the application of it? We may not find ourselves guilty of worshiping Tammuz, not involved in a pagan rite such as this, but can we boil down in essence what they were doing? They were worshiping here a god for profit. So long as they could keep Tammuz alive and well, they were going to prosper. And so they were worshiping here a god for profit. They were worshiping a god for what they were going to get out of that god. You see? Now I say, while the names have been changed, that mentality is not far, far foreign from the day in which we live. We have those, some in the perverted charismatic movement that are worshiping a Tammuz. They are worshiping a god for profit. Lord, what will you do for me? What can I get out of this, be it health or wealth or whatever? What am I going to get out of this if I worship you? And you have those that are committing their lives to Christ, yes, for what they're going to get out of the deal. And there's no focus upon the glory of God, and there's no focus upon worshiping the Lord and serving the Lord for the sake of God Himself. And you're making deals and bargains with God. Well, God knows that kind of heart, and God sees that kind of heart. And in essence, it's nothing more than a weeping for Tammuz, a worshiping and a serving a God for profit. And I say that kind of idea is not far removed from some of the theology even that we have around us today. True worship is going to rest upon that God who lives regardless of the evidence of circumstances. They thought Tammuz was dead when things weren't going right for them. But our God lives regardless of circumstances, and it's faith that takes us beyond circumstances and beyond the appearances and evidences of life to know that our God always lives and He always rules. And faith in Him is the solution to the difficulties and the trials and what have you. But that's taking it for now in a different line. We come back to our text. It gets worse yet. If that wasn't bad enough, it gets worse yet. Verse 15. Then said he unto me, Hast thou seen this, O Son of Man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. And they worship the sun toward the east. Here becomes the most abominable of all. They were departed from the Lord, not without significance here, that we're told that their backs were toward the temple. Graphic demonstration here that true worship and false worship are incompatible one with the other. You cannot truly worship the Lord and be involved in these aspects of false worship as well. You cannot truly worship the Lord and have within your heart that a false conception of who the Lord is, that goddess of love, that image of jealousy. You cannot truly worship the Lord and have in your minds those perverted things and that false view of God as Tammuz even. You can't have them both. It's incompatible. They are mutually exclusive one from the other. And here we find the very essence as these who were worshiping now had their backs toward the temple. That place that did represent the presence of the Lord and the Holy, they've turned their backs. And now they were facing a different direction. And they were worshiping the sun, a degradation of that good work of God. The sun was God's gift. And the sun was one of those aspects of God's creation that declare the glory of God Himself. The psalmist in Psalm 19, when he speaks of the heavens declaring the glory of God, singles out one particular aspect of that creation. It's the sun. And he views the sun as that bridegroom that is swift and eager to know his bride and to run the race, the vitality as the sun participates in the declaration of the glory of God. That creation of God, which is a manifestation of His glory, but here they've taken that gift of God and they've severed the gift from the Creator. And to use the gift and to focus upon the gift apart from the Creator, the giver of the gift, always is going to result in a perversion of the gift itself. They severed the tie with the Lord, and now they were going in a completely different direction. Here's this sun worship, taking part of God's creation, seeing it apart from the Creator and perverting it and degrading it into that which drew their attentions away from the Lord. Now, those four aspects then, four different abominations, each one, as it were, getting worse than the other. And that's what God was seeing as these people were worshiping. All right, so that's the practice of false worship. Now, let me say a couple of things here about those that were participating in this false worship. Notice in verse 11, And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel. And in the midst of them stood Jehazaniah, the son of Shaphan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. All right, the 70 elders were there. The 70 elders were there. Verse 16 that we just read, there were 25 men there. And These seem to be the representatives of the priesthood, their location in the temple. What they should have been doing here perverted, here are the priests. 25 priests, the 70 elders. Those that were the representatives of the people. The representatives of the people. The leaders of the people were here given over to this perversion of worship. And it's most interesting there in verse 17 that one man particularly is named for us. Jahazaniah, the son of Shaphan, is there specifically named as being a participant in this false worship. If you go back to 2 Kings, we find something about his father, Shaphan, that is mentioned here in 2 Kings chapter 22. Verses 3 and following, I won't take time to read this entire section here. Verse all the way through verse 20 is germane to what I want to say here. But you'll notice in verse 3, "And it came to pass in the 18th year of King Josiah that the king sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, the son of Meshulam, the scribe, to the house of the Lord, saying," and so forth and so forth. Verse 9, verse 8 and 9, Shaphan is mentioned again. Shaphan the scribe came to the king and so forth. Shaphan the scribe. This Shaphan, a scribe during the time of Josiah, was one of the key influential factors in that great religious revival, that great religious reform that was taking place, that took place during the time of Josiah. When the book of the law was found, and Josiah read the book of the law, and he was brought under that great conviction and overturned all of the perversions of the past, of Manasseh and so forth, and we have a great revival taking place. Some of it a real spiritual revival, some just reforms. But Shaphan, nonetheless, was one of the key influential characters in the establishment of that reformation that took place during Josiah's time. And here he is now. Here it is. Now a generation later. And here is his son that was given over to this great perversion of worship. Instrumental in reversing that revival and that reformation that his father had begun. That is a terrible warning to us here. It's a terrible warning for Christian parents. It's a terrible warning for Christian young people. That just having godly parents, does not assure the proper relationship with the Lord. I believe in the covenant promises that God has given to parents. The promise is given to us and to our seed, and I believe that very strongly. But while I believe that and I claim that and I pray that for my children and I both must understand that just because they're born into a Christian home does not guarantee them, apart from their own personal experience of faith in Jesus Christ, it does not guarantee them life with God. And so I say there's a warning for every Christian parent. Here was Shaphan, a godly man. And now here's his kid that was influential in the reversal of every advance for the kingdom of Christ that he had made. Terrible warning there. One that we must well pray about. And the priesthood was there. There's the religious leader. Just being in the ministry doesn't assure you the proper relationship with God either. And here are the representatives. Elders, perverted in their hearts. Priests, perverted in their hearts. The children of believers, perverted in their hearts. And God was seeing it all. And it stands, I say, as a great warning. That just having a name, just having an office, just having a ministry is not what God's looking for. God's looking at the heart. God's looking at the heart. Well, there's a few more things that I need to say about this chapter. And that'll wait till next week. All right, Steve, would you close us today?